Coming up in This Week in Computer Hardware, Micron's 5100 Max and Eco Enterprise SSDs. Do you want them in your home PC? A fresh thermal compound roundup and a mayonnaise update just in time for Ryzen, FSP Twins, 500-watt ATX redundant power supply unit, and more. It's all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and once again, time for Twitch audience survey. We'd really like to hear from you. It's only going to take a couple of minutes, really. That's all. Just go to twit.tv/survey and let us know what you think. Your anonymous feedback will help us make Twit even better. And thanks for your continued support.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 400, recorded February 2nd, 2017. Enterprise hardware fails hard. It's a good thing. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by iFixit. You've seen their teardowns all over the internet, the free repair guide for everything, and the ultimate marketplace for electronic tools and parts. For $5 off your purchase of $10 or more, go to iFixit.com/twit and enter the code Twitch at checkout. And also by BarkBox. BarkBox Paw picks the best all-natural treats and innovative toys for your dog and ships them right to your door. To receive a free month of BarkBox with your 6- or 12-month subscription and free shipping, visit getbarkbox.com/twit. Welcome to Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that aims to bring you the most useful, most informative, most engaging, and most helpful computer news and, repair, how-to, and fun advice. We're here for the fun with the mobile, the fun with the desktop, and mostly the fun with the gaming, and the video creating. And I should probably take a moment to introduce Mr. Al Malventano, who's joining us in place of Ryan, who is, would you believe it, traveling, possibly in Southern California as we speak. Alan, welcome back.
Howdy.
How's it going? It's going good, man. The rumor mill has started flooding up again around AMD, which is to basically confirm all of the rumors we had and all the conversations we had at CES to say that Ryzen, March, possibly March 1st. They'll tell us more in February. I'm excited. Are you giddy with anticipation?
I mean, I'm excited to see competition, like actual competition for Intel on the CPU front, you know, because you need that. Just saying.
Competition in the marketplace increases performance, reduces prices, and actually you have sort of a half argument for that, except that it's kind of half a product that's targeted at the enterprise market, not the desktop market. But I'm talking about is SSDs and Micron. Woo, Micron with the 5100 Max and the Eco 1920. These are huge drives, like 960 gigabytes for the Max, the 1920 gigabytes for the Eco.
Not just that, realize that they're doing a phased rollout of this product line. Over the next few months, we're going to see the Eco go all the way up to an 8 terabyte model.
Whoa, that's like.
In the same form factor.
$456 for the Eco.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it'll be expensive.
Excuse me, the 8 terabyte Eco.
Yeah.
Which is technically.
It'll be expensive, but it'll be a very large capacity SSD. More importantly, though, it'll be a large capacity SSD with hopefully the same amazing performance consistency that I saw when I was looking at these two particular products here. On the. Let's see, just to make it sort of brief, if you go to either of the saturated QoS and paste pages of that article, we're doing some, you know, kind of new ways of showing data, new ways of testing when it comes to enterprise products. And the first chart on, I think if you're on the right page, yeah, you're on the right page. Basically, we're just looking at a high-resolution version of QoS results. So there's a table up there that just shows, here's our QoS, you know, ratings, and they just give you like a latency and a percentage or percentile. So they're like, you know, at 99.9%, all the latencies are going to be faster than X.
Right.
We present that in a little bit more fine-grained detail. We actually give like the entire ramp, and you can see the line kind of crossing through the various numbers of nines. And on that chart, you'll notice the lines are basically just vertical. What you usually see with an SSD is what thing called a tail latency, which is where that line, as it goes vertical through, you know, up higher numbers of nines, higher, you know, very smaller and smaller fractions getting closer to 100%. Usually the line kind of makes a right, and there'll be some IOs that were just slower, and that'll show as a tail. Basically, the line will just kind of curve off to the right. In other words, longer latencies for a few of the remaining IOs. These SSDs, they pretty much just don't go higher than a few milliseconds, like ever.
Ever.
As a matter of fact,
this is a good thing.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, because usually, like in the past, you'll have some SSDs where every so often there just needs to be some kind of garbage collection or something that takes a higher priority than what the host is asking for, and even if it's just a very small fraction of the time, it still happens. These tend to just not do that at all. It's like they figured out finally how to make the firmware in such a way and how to make the whole pipeline in such a way where no matter what, at all costs, never take too long to do stuff, right?
Is that a function of them being targeted sort of enterprise servers, or is that an advancement that Micron might trickle down into more consumer-oriented drives?
Well, for consumer-oriented drives, you can put priorities in other places. In other words, you can give garbage collection a little bit of a higher priority, or you can just do your garbage collection in a different way that's better tailored for a consumer product. In other words, you know, have lower over-provisioning, like less extra flash available, kind of, you know, turn some of the dials in such a way where things might be even a little bit snappier than the enterprise drive from a consumer standpoint, but it can't sustain that across the whole drive like 24/7, just continuous hammering, right? So in that respect, enterprise drives as a whole might still be a little bit, you know, a little bit slower than the equivalent consumer product. But the key here is that it's like slow and steady wins the race, right? These are just extremely consistent in the case of the 5100 series, to the point where, I mean, it was really impressive. There were a lot of cases where some charts I didn't put in the article, but I have the ability to extend those charts all the way up to like as many percent of nines as I want. It could be literally be like 1/1,000,000th of a percent below 100%. And still, those lines were still, you know, chugging up like basically straight vertical without really any sort of a tail latency to speak of. So the reason that's important for enterprise is because if you put something like this in things like an online transaction processing server, there are things where every single transaction is, you don't want to time out, right? You don't want your credit, your particular credit card transaction to time out in some database somewhere and have to be, you know, reissued, and basically you're sitting there at some kiosk somewhere waiting, right? Like, you don't, people don't want to wait. That's the whole point of these things, right? Make sure everything is done very consistently and as quickly as possible. Yes, people don't want to wait. I know. They're like,
people love waiting. You know. Well, the flip side of this, I mean, a distinct warning you make, right? PC Perspective, Gold Award, fantastic product. Amazing performance. Yeah. But one of the things you point out is because these are enterprise, because these are targeted at the enterprise, if you go to the very last page, you have a warning to non-IT pros. It basically says, you know, where a consumer part might have a fail or an issue reading and it would just keep trying over and over again, you know, IT specialists, you write, don't like wasting time on intermittent faults and silent data corruption. If something is wrong in the slightest, an IT pro just wants the thing to fail hard so they can replace it and get a portion of their network back up ASAP.
Yeah, you don't want something on its way to failing and have it still operating, right? And not for what this particular product is tailored for, and really any enterprise SSD for that matter. So there used to be, you know, back when like SandForce SSDs and like back when kind of like in the early days of consumer SSDs, you'd have occasionally power users would want to spend an extra few bucks per gigabyte. And yes, they used to be dollars per gigabyte to get an enterprise part because they thought that the performance would be better, or in some cases the performance was better than the equivalent consumer part. But they might not have considered that, hey, some of these things, especially nowadays, the firmware is just designed to just fail hard when it sees things going a little bit sideways. It could have been a situation where that drive would have never given you bad data and it would have ran for another 10 years just fine. But if there was a hint of it, the firmwares tend to be tuned to kind of like, you know, fail conservative, you know, and in Intel's case, very, very conservative. I bricked an enterprise drive of theirs just because I hot plugged it and it just didn't like it.
The moral of that story is if you choose to use an enterprise SSD in your, you know, workstation, in your production environment, in your home, on your gaming rig, have everything backed up like every freaking day, or when it crashes, you may be weeping quietly in a corner trying to figure out how you will go on.
Because these things are meant to go in locations where there is failover. In other words, there is an active second copy of everything that's alive and just ready to be flipped over to as sort of an immediate swap in backup. You know, and unless you're doing something like that or some form of raid, I wouldn't use, you know, any of these for like personal use.
Copy that.
Shiva plans a spinoff storage business, sells 20% of new company. Tim Berry wrote this up for PC Per. So Toshiba bought Westinghouse, which you may know from having some issues or cost overruns in the U.S. nuclear market, which is kicking Toshiba's posteriors financially. Toshiba, of course, having already sold off its consumer PC business not too long ago. But the latest news is that Toshiba is going to take its memory business, spin that off into a new company, which is a big business for Toshiba. But they're going to spin the memory business off into a new company and then sell a 20% stake in that company, which is a really interesting way to raise money. Toshiba's second largest memory manufacturer behind Samsung. Very, very big, very, very in need of cash. And is this a chance for, I mean, who's left in terms of traditional hard drives that hasn't seriously partnered up with an SSD manufacturer already?
I mean, there's not many, right? Western Digital now is coupled up with SanDisk, who makes their own flash, right? And not only that, but they've already launched some products, you know, on a Western Digital brand, their consumer SSDs with SanDisk flash in them. There's really not a lot. I mean, HGST also falls under Western Digital. So now, those guys don't have to worry about it, right? I think it was Seagate that ended up with what LSI had, which was the SandForce group, I think. There's been so many jugglings and changing of hands of all the, you know, technology groups in sort of this consolidation of everything. You might have some companies left that have, that might have some controller tech, but they don't necessarily have flash tech, which would be good to have, right? There is supposedly 3D NAND coming from Toshiba. It's called BICS. BICS is just the branding for their style of 3D NAND, but it's not ready. At CES, I visited OCZ and they showed me here's our product line, and it was all the products we've already reviewed, right? Because I looked at them and they're like, well, you know, shrugged their shoulders, like, we're waiting on BICS. Like, once that's out in a few months, supposedly. Then they can launch new rounds of products based on that. Hopefully at a much improved cost per gigabyte, because that's what most of this, you know, 3D NAND stuff is leading to, right? Very cost-effective drives, sort of like those 5100s we just talked about, enterprise drives running at like 50 cents a gig, right? Super cheap because they were using 3D NAND and they were using it in TLC mode, which is what, you know, where everybody's kind of going. I did think it was just kind of comical. It's like, if only there was a name of what to call this company to spin off of Toshiba, like a name that already associated with the branding and stuff like that.
Toshiba Memory Systems? OCZ?
That one.
That's a tough one to bring the love to the OCZ name. Toshiba's doing their best. And they've done some pretty good product relaunches, but I think a lot of OCZ owners are still angry about OCZ's collapse. Meanwhile, in radically different news, before we take a moment to thank one of our sponsors, Asus has delivered the Tinkerboard, because you can never have enough single board computers. The 90MB0QY1-M0EAY0, again, the Tinker board, basically matches the layout of the Raspberry Pi 3, 4K, 8.264 video decode support, I believe in hardware. Another write-up by Tim Vary here. 4 by USB 2.0, gigabit Ethernet, which I love, HDMI 2.0, which means it'll support 4K, micro SD, micro USB for power, you know, audio outputs, 40-pin header, 28-pin GPIO, camera, display attachments, SPDIF solder points, PWM solder points. So it's pretty cool. It's a ROC chip RK3288, so it's an ARM Cortex A17 CPU and a Mali T764 GPU. So it's got some bump, some boost to it. Even better yet, 2 gigabytes of LPDDR3 memory, 802.11 radios, Bluetooth 4.0. So basically twice the RAM, and in theory, twice the processing power. So, you know, not particularly easy to find at this point. Currently up for sale on Farnell, which is a British retailer. Debian OS and Kodi are supposed to be running on it already. I do not have too much more information on how the on what operating system support is on that. And of course, like we run into on almost every single board PC, is that if it's not a Raspberry Pi, and I've got to give some love to the crew in Oakland, you know, with the $9 PC. You know, where they are building a community. The primary advantage of the Raspberry Pi is that there's this huge community with all these distros that are available on that. And the nice thing is, you know, it's one thing to be like a Linux guru who lives in the command line and be like, the Odroid is amazing. And in terms of performance, it is. But if you're a relative newbie, it doesn't have a lot of experience with Linux, it can be enormously frustrating to get that to run. So that's the advantage of the Raspberry Pi. I'll be curious to see how the Tinker board stacks up in that area. You know, and it's interesting to watch, right? Because the chip PC, the $9 chip PC, started years after the Raspberry Pi. But a big part of their effort is to build a community and lots of projects around their platform. So Farnell is the link for that. Yeah, 45 pounds. So I want to say about twice the cost for Raspberry Pi 3. I have not found a U.S. retailer for them yet. So
I'm sure they'll trickle over here and people will tinker away.
Well, the performance is really compelling. So it'd be fun to see what operating systems are on there.
We on the podcast last night where we were talking about, first we were talking about all of the things you would have to do to get 4K HDR to work on a PC, like, you know, Kaby Lake and like special, you know, Blu-ray player and this and that, all these boxes you had to check to get that working. And then we talked about this, which could potentially do hardware, like minus the copy protection, it could potentially do all the other things just in this little really cheap device that costs less than any of the one things you had to buy to swap out in your desktop PC to make that work.
Oh, the cruelty.
Yep.
Oh, my goodness. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by iFixit. I love iFixit. They got more than 22,000 free repair guides, 90,000 troubleshooting solutions. The crew at iFixit are experts in consumer electronics repair, and they want you to be an expert, too. That's why they provide all the repair knowledge you need for free. The guides are amazing if you've never checked them out. They sell a wide array of parts and tools to help you get the job done, and they know what they're doing. That's why they built the ProTech Toolkit. It's awesome. I use this thing literally every other day, repairing kids' toys, repairing electronics, cracking open iPhones, although hopefully my new iPhone doesn't disintegrate because I have armor wrapped around it. This is the newest version of the ProTech Toolkit. They looked at the old one and they thought, how can we make it easier to use? How can we make it better? And they did a really good job, right? Nice canvas case, and possibly the best thing about it is the iFixit 64-bit driver kit. So it's got all the nice magnetic top on that. So instead of having to be like, I open up the ProTech Toolkit, I pull out the bit case, I unlatch the bit case, I break the latch on the bit case, magnetic top, and look at all of the tools inside of there. It's awesome, right? The steel bits in the driver kit are pretty good. Precision ESD safe tweezers, a pair of reverse tweezers to get stuff out of the dark corners of a small case, plastic opening tools, spudgers, picks so you can open up tablets and smartphones, a suction cup for display assembly removal. Makes it so much easier to get a display off of something if you can get a little bit of grip with a suction cup. this is probably the last precision toolkit you'll ever need, in no small part because the ProTek toolkit is backed by a lifetime guarantee from the crew at iFixit, who just wants you to go out and make things last forever by fixing them. Oh, look at the spudgers. People at iFixit.com, never stop preparing them. With this toolkit under your belt, you won't either. Head over to iFixit.com/twit and use the code TWICH at checkout to save $5 on your purchase of $10 or more. Even if you don't buy anything, you can still use their free repair guides, troubleshooting answers forum, and other educational resources on their website anytime your tech has an accident. And we want to thank iFixit for their support. Man, what have I used that for in just the last week? Pentalobe screws, tightening, putting together a memory upgrade on a laptop, repairing children's toys, fixing the screws on eyeglasses. No toilet repairs this week with the ProTek toolkit, but I have repaired toilets with it in the past.
So I have used that toolkit and even the older version of that toolkit and even their macro bit set, which is like the quarter-inch drive version of all that stuff. They're all sitting on my dining room table right there because I just had them all out to install a lock. Anyway, I fixed one thing the other night that I didn't need that for and I thought would be worthy of bringing up because it's the exact kind of thing that people usually need one of those toolkits to replace, because usually when you crack your screen on your phone, you have to just, get another one, right? You're just like, hey, you're just kind of screwed. Well, I got... apparently, if an iPhone the screen cracks with a single hairline crack first, it's actually a warranty replacement if there's no damage due to a drop. And apparently, I had a defective screen.
Oh, wow.
Well, because there's just no damage around the crack. It's just like there's just a crack, like with no, like there's no, the case isn't bent, nothing, like where the crack starts and ends, right? And I actually had that happen. And I got a hairline crack occur right in front of me. Like it started at the edge and I thought there was a hair on the screen and I'm like, went to wipe the hair off and it literally right in front of my eyes just went and just ran right up the screen. And I was like,
oh, that'll,
what the heck happened? Right. And so went to the Apple store and they're like, oh yeah, this is warranty this, warranty that. Well, they looked up my serial. Turns out it was 2 months out of warranty. Oh, sorry, sir. That'll be $150. I was like, let me see if I could figure out some other way to do this other than $150. So I have no idea if this is going to come out on the camera. But along the top edge of this phone that looks like it's just a mirror, there was a crack. It was literally running all the way, like it kind of eclipsed around the edge and half mooned all the way up the screen. And the crack's gone, at least as far as you can tell. Like it's just, it's very hard to even see it anymore. Without dwelling on and on, I used a long crack windshield repair resin.
Nice.
In other words, the resin you use to fill a long, like a crack that is spidered across a windshield of a car that's super, super low viscosity. You can, if you look around, you can pick these things up for like $2 or $3 for a little vial of it. You need a UV light or to just sit the thing out in the sun once you have applied the resin and it is kind of seeped its way into the crack. And you might just need like a suction cup to kind of like relieve the pressure on the glass to kind of like open up the gap a little bit for the resin to kind of like wick into it. But it was almost like magic. Like I put a drop of that resin on there, put a suction cup on it. And as I lifted on the suction cup, I could literally just watch it just run down the crack. And basically that resin is the same diffraction index as just regular glass, because the idea is to make the crack invisible. And it just did it. I don't know how long it's going to hold up for, but that's potentially a couple of dollar replacement. It's not going to fix if you spidered the crack out of your screen and you dropped it and you caused damage. It's probably not going to do that great. But if you got one of those hairline cracks in it, might be a cheap fix. Just throwing it out there. I was impressed.
You're excited.
I spent $2 worth of something that I didn't even have to open up the phone to fix. Literally just put a drop of it on there and it just, oh look, the crack looks like it's gone. If you really look close, you can tell that there is a slight difference in the height of the screen at that point. So you can kind of see almost as if you had a drop of water on your screen. Yeah, you have to look for it, and I'm usually super picky about that stuff. And literally 5 minutes after fixing it, I went to use the phone and I was like, I didn't even notice the crack anymore. It wasn't to the point, I have to look for it. Anyway, we'll see if it lasts. I don't know.
I'll check
back next time we're on the show or something and see if my $2 fix for a cracked screen still works.
I would be surprised if it didn't last, because if it's actually drawn into there and sealing the crack, it should be good to go.
At a minimum, it's going to prevent it from spidering further or branching off or, you know, doing anything worse. Right. So,
ladies and gentlemen, windshield adhesive, something you might want to tuck inside of your ProTech toolkit from iFixit. iFixit.com/twit. Enter the code TWICH to save $5 off a $10 purchase. We're talking with Padre before the show about the AMD Ryzen processors, you know, coming out in March. We're all excited. All the processors are going to be unlocked, which, of course, has me thinking about overclocking, although not all of the motherboards will support overclocking. We'll talk more about that when the release happens. But KitGuru did a review, a roundup of thermal paste, and I haven't seen one in a long time. And they basically asked, does it matter which brand you use? And if you skip over to the second page on that, their best results was with Thermal Grizzly Cryonaut, Arctic Silver 5, which I'm pretty sure I still have a tube laying in my toolbox, was about four degrees Celsius higher. I thought it was odd that the Thermal Grizzly Cryonaut was warmer at idle but colder when they were running Prime 95 for a stress test. You know, but it's a reminder that if you want to save a few degrees here and there, which can be a big deal for getting the most computing out of your Intel processor, it's not a bad idea to keep an eye on your thermal paste. Conversely, if you are not overclocking, this is a strong sign that almost anything will do a decent job as a thermal paste, connecting your cooler to your processor. With that in mind, I was looking around for Hardware Secrets. It was kind of like the last crew to do big giant roundups of dozens of thermal pastes. And one of the things they did is they started doing things like chocolate and mayonnaise. And I'd never seen the article that they did back in 2013 where they asked, does mayonnaise last as a thermal compound? Because mayonnaise was actually incredibly competitive and much better than a lot of the thermal compounds that were sold as thermal compounds. But they basically used Hellman's mayonnaise, ran it on there, and it was actually pretty good for the first 24 hours. But after that, it ended up being about 6 degrees hotter, I guess, after they sort of, permanently fused the mayonnaise to the processor and the cooler, and that it did oxidize the snot out of the cap of the CPU and the CPU cooler after about 12 days. So it's even in its sort of dried out, horrifying state, it was better than no thermal compound. But as soon as it dried out, it was not too good. But if you've never seen the...
It was great because it was eating into the heat spreader on the CPU.
Well, it was... I mean, this was... You know, these roundups need to go back to, 2012. And, they went from everything from no thermal compounds and literally did dozens of thermal compounds. I don't think many of these are still sold today. But at that point, when they were looking at the deltas between them, you could see no thermal compound. There was a 62 degree difference between the room temperature and the core temperature on the processor. And the better thermal compounds dropped that to, 33, 35, 36 degrees. And the lesser thermal compounds were up around 42 degrees, 40 degrees. Mustard, 38 degrees Celsius, which actually makes it better than some of the commercial at least a couple of the thermal compounds. I'd also like to point out that, thermal compound does dry out after time. So if you're building an AMD Ryzen or another new processor or just replacing a heatsink or putting liquid cooling on, that three-year-old tube of thermal compound may not be... if the solvents inside of it have dried out, it can be difficult to apply and actually create a thicker layer between the processor than you want between the processor and the cooler. So if make sure it's still kind of liquidy and soft. If it's like squeezing out the world's thickest peanut butter, buy a new tube, or you may be remounting that cooler in a few days. Hard OCP, I love Kyle and the crew. They've been playing around with Kaby Lake i7 7700Ks. They did a full D-lid and relid. which basically means they pulled the heat spreader off of the processor because, you know,
less stuff in the way.
Yeah, you know, and the thermal compound between the processor, there's the processor right there. There's normally, there it is. And that's like that's Intel's, thermal compound. And they basically found out that the thermal interface material, the goop in between the heat spreader and the processor kind of sucks, which is, I think, one of the reasons why you find that, you know, certain cores are hotter or, you know, their goal was to see if they could really, you know, if they could hit 5,000, if they could finally hit the elusive, like, 5,000 hertz on that one, which they did not reach. But overall, it was... You know, replacing the thermal compound from Intel, or what they call the Kaby Lake Custom TIM, you know, resulted in a huge, huge delta, from like 91 degrees centigrade down to 68 degrees. Did not hit their 5 gigahertz, 3600 megahertz overclocking target, but they did reduce the amount of power it required to overclock, and they had significant temperature reductions. And if you're really crazy and you want to get some help delitting your brand new Kaby Lake processor because you're a wild creature and living at the edge, the Tech Report has a great link to a 3D printable design for a Kaby Lake delitting tool. So if you're feeling kind of life on the edge, that is the tool for you. If you're feeling somewhat less than life on the edge, there's a good article up on PC Per this week. Excuse me, on Hard OCP this week. My apologies. Paul Johnson did the review. The FSP Twins 500-watt ATX redundant power supply, which is literally two 500-watt power supplies in a standard ATX size. They do a 700-watt version, a 500-watt version. The Hard OCP crew looked at the 500-watt version. It's essentially, that is two 500-watt ATX power supplies inside of a ATX power supply-sized case. Not the best measurements in terms of some of the more hardcore power measurements that they do over at Hard OCP, but certainly more than enough performance to run your home server. And as the crew over there points out, this is, you know, if you find yourself killing power supplies because you have that computer stuffed in a closet or in some other hot room in the house, you know, this is designed like full on hardcore commercial. I'm in a terrible server room, server power supply, and doing their best to deliver something that won't fail. And should one of them fail, they're hot swappable and they will keep things running. So, not the first dual redundant power supply they've seen, but at $400, a little bit more affordable to say the least. Not that that's particularly cheap, but if you're looking for something extremely redundant, because I have to be able to stream my music, this is the power supply for you.
Well, although be careful with using that and the streaming of the music. Because Lee also took a look at the same power supply. I guess these guys are really doing like a PR push and like trying to get these into a bunch of hands. So Lee looked at it, and I mean, similar results to what RCP got. The only catch was that he also noted that those two modules are using 40-millimeter fans at the rear.
Yeah.
And while they throttle on their own, and they are, you know, variable speed like setup with temperature feedback and whatnot. As soon as you go over a certain amount of load, they start to spin up. And, I think Lee said something about to the point of annoying. Like, I think he used a word that he doesn't usually use in the context of trying to describe the noise coming from the fans. So
when I was, I was talking, this is as the host for the music files that was serving
my host.
Music.
Okay.
Absolutely. Well, no one who has heard this power supply wants to be in the same room with it.
but realize, I mean, being ATX form factor, it's very likely that someone might want to put it in just a desktop style system, you know, and have it sitting, you know, assuming it's just like a workstation system sitting next to their desk, right? So, yeah. Anyway. Yeah. Yep, there they are. Not only are they the 40-millimeter ones, they're like the beefy, deep 40-millimeter fans.
Beefy.
The ones that really make the turbine spun up you know, super high pitch sound, right?
There's nothing wrong with a super high pitch sound driving you completely insane if you're into that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I don't know that a lot of people are actually into the sound of a giant mosquito from hell screaming near the floor, but if you're into that,
this is also the power supply for you.
Oh my goodness. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by BarkBox. BarkBox delivers 4 to 6 natural treats and fun toys for your dog curated around a surprise theme each month. Themes, people. We like themes. BarkBox Paw picks all the best all-natural treats and innovative toys to match your dog's unique needs, including allergies, heavy chewer preferences. All edibles are made in the USA or Canada, and 100% of their products are tested on animals their own. I like this. Got to keep the pets safe, people. BarkBox is a great way to try a variety of treats and toys from local and small businesses that you may not otherwise be able to find. BarkBox also makes their own Paw Ducks through their Bark & Co. brand. They've shipped over 16 million toys and treats so far. And getting started, getting your pet hooked up, so easy. Choose your dog size, small and cute, up to 20 pounds, just right, 20 to 50 pounds, or big and bold, that's 50 plus pounds. Choose a plan, 1, 6, or 12-month plans are available. And you get your BarkBox, it's shipped out on the 15th of each month. BarkBox will keep your dog engaged, interested, and happy. If your dog doesn't like something in the BarkBox, they'll send you something else for free. Scout's honor. How cool is that? When your dog falls in love with something from the box, you can easily find it again on BarkShop.com or the BarkBox app. You can cancel any time, and shipping is free in the continental U.S. People, give your dog the joy of a million belly scratches. Get 1 month free and free shipping for your 6 or 12 month subscription visiting GetBarkBox.com/twit. That's GetBarkBox.com/twit, and we want to thank BarkBox for their support.
Happy puppies. Who wants a happy puppy? Oh, my goodness.
We got to take a look at the Black Widow. We got to take a look at the latest Razer keyboard, the Black Widow Chrome V2. Shannon got it in for testing. What you're looking at right there is the new yellow keys. And I'm really happy that the keyboard Shannon looked at did not have yellow keys. It had the green keys from Razer. Greens are similar to MX Blues. The orange are very, very similar to MX Browns that have a bumpy tactile response with no click. The blues are basically they have a nice clicky response, which is, of course, something I'm into. Those are the two that have been around for a while. The yellow is linear and silent, and I agree with that to the point where I thought I was working on a membrane key, which drives me completely insane. But there are people who believe, Razer believes that's going to, make you faster because the actuation point, the reset point are so delightfully close. I do not like the lack of tactile response. I do not like the lack of noise. Again, it makes me think of a membrane keyboard, but it is one of the multiple options available from Razer. Black Widow Chroma V2, really, really nice. Shannon's particularly in love with the detachable wrist rest on that. Fully programmable, 16 billion key colors available in the Razer's custom green, orange, or yellow switches. They're nice. They're nice keyboards. $170, which is not inexpensive, but typical for a fully programmable LED backlit 16 million colors of happy keyboard. But something to be aware of. There's always another key somewhere in the market.
Yep.
Did you catch the news on AMD? AMD's financials. Not that we're a big financial show, but I think we're all kind of concerned. We want AMD to survive.
Yeah. They're doing better, or I could say they're doing less worse, but that still counts as better, right?
A backhanded compliment, but a compliment nonetheless. Right? Josh wrote this up at PC for 1.11 billion dollars in U.S. sales in Q4 with a $51 million net loss, which is a big deal when you look at Q3, which is $1.3 billion in sales and $293 million in losses.
Definitely an improvement. There's really no way around that. Right.
So
they were selling, they probably, no doubt they sold a lot of GPUs, I would imagine, you know, last quarter. Yes. And, you know, hopefully this coming quarter, they're going to start selling a whole bunch of CPUs too. Right.
That would be nuts.
Yeah.
That would be very, very nice. So yeah, good luck, AMD. Hit the Ryzen release date, make it affordable so we can all buy one and you can make money. I don't know. The whole idea of like $1 billion in earnings and still losing $50 million is just, that's intense. This is why I'm not a CEO. Basemark's VR score, the world's first comprehensive VR benchmark, is official. Went into early access like a year ago. It's officially available now. Some of the versions are not completely available. It's going to be five versions, from a simple free version to corporate premium. You know, this is very, very similar to Basemark's current products. You know, in that there's like a 3D Mark free and 3D Mark paid versions. You know, this is cool because you can basically run the 4K 3D benchmark. That'll give you an idea of how your system would perform. If you don't have a headset, what's really cool about this one, if you spend all the money for the commercial version, there it is, the physical headset latency tester, which tests the latency in both eyes simultaneously, so you can see how good your headset actually is in the real world. So,
yep. We have one of those in the office. It's really just a couple of photodiodes, you know, sitting at the leading edge of that, and then you just kind of set the headset up against the fork end of it, I guess, if you will.
And watch it blink.
Yeah, and basically it sends some kind of, you know, some kind of output to the headset through the whole video pipeline that would, you know, do some kind of flashes on the screen, and it's able to just pick those up and send them, you know, send them onto the PC. Ooh, yes, 3D animation of the fork being inserted into the eyeballs.
Yeah. Which point, okay.
I mean, you know,
media version.
We'll toy around with it and see how well it does.
Media version's available now. Corporate version's available now. That's why you guys have the media version. The free version and the professional versions are coming in Q2 2017. Mm-hmm. So, exciting. VR becoming more mainstream each and every second. One last thought before we go. If you are tempted to participate in the world of 3D but still don't want to spend all the money on an upgraded PC and a headset, there's a Kickstarter for you if you're feeling adventurous, and I can understand why you might not be, given a couple of high-profile Kickstarter failures in the past few months. Nolo VR, they say they're going to let you play Steam VR games on your smartphones. $99, 60OF motion tracking system, front-facing room scale, low latency, Android compatible, and created for mobile VR headsets. So they have completed their fund. Well, they have 36 days to go. They've already raised $120,000, almost $121,000 on their $50,000 goal. And, yeah, they want you to be able to play Steam games on your phone. And cool. Basically, you're getting the controllers and the tracking device. So, and I assume a headset. So I'm stoked about that. Oh, there it is. Yeah. I don't know. I'm excited. Because the headsets are still really expensive, and we don't see them getting that much cheaper anytime soon.
Yeah.
And you, sir, I believe have to run to go to the airport. So is there anything you can tease that's coming up on PC Per before you go?
We rolled out that new version of the enterprise testing for that 5100 piece. So I'm playing catch up on a whole bunch of those pieces. Now that we have like a good solid, kind of test regimen running on stuff. And I'm also playing catch up on some consumer SSDs that, when we rolled out the new version of the consumer suite, I ended up with, I think almost 150 SSD results. But problem is, we have some SSD results in our comparison charts now that have not received the full review of their own yet. So kind of things went a little backwards and sideways there. So I'm playing catch up on that too. So there's probably going to be a whole slew of, you know, just individual consumer SSD reviews just to kind of speak to their, you know, those results that have already kind of made it into our charts.
There you have it, people. Ladies and gentlemen, PCPer.com is a place to find the best hardware reviews available in the planet. Although I'm sure Kyle and the crew at Hardware CP would argue about that. And everybody else who reviews hardware would argue about it too, because that's what keeps everybody on the bleeding edge. But Alan's writing the benchmarks, people. You should know that already. At Malventano, you can find Mr. Malventano on Twitter. At Malventano, you can find me at Patrick Norton. at Ryan Trout. We'll be back next week. And of course, I want to invite you to join me on at Tech Thing, which is technically techthing.com, which is my other show. And we want to thank each and every one of you out there for listening. And to those who have been upset at my use of, you know, and or other phrases, I hope there was a minimum of them in this episode of This Week in Computer Hardware. Twitch.tv/Twitch is the place to find all our older episodes and how to subscribe. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Alan Valentano.
We'll catch you next week on Twitch.